Deutsche Welle. Living Planet.
Hello and welcome to Living Planet. I'm your host, Charlotte Lomas. This week, we'll head to the drought-stricken parts of California, where farmers are combating food waste through social media. We'll wander down the back streets of Sao Paulo, where vacant lots are being transformed into productive urban gardens. And we'll meet a couple of Latvians who became climate activists by accident. All this and more here on Living Planet. But first, we head to southern Tunisia, where a mysterious new lake has reportedly emerged in the Gafsa region. But it's not yet known how the water made it to this drought-stricken region. Earlier, I spoke with DW reporter Navina Couture to get the details.
It's about a hectare in width, and it's believed to be between 10 to 18 metres deep. Shepherds reportedly discovered this lake in the desert about 3 weeks ago, and since then pictures have emerged, people are going swimming there. But it's a desert terrain, so it's quite unusual for this amount of water to appear in the middle of a desert.
Navina, do we know how the lake was formed exactly?
No, the local scientists are in the process of trying to find out what exactly happened there. There's some theories that there might have been a very, very small earthquake that caused a tremor and ruptured the rocks, and that water rose to the top and filled up the space that was there. The other theory some people have is that it was just the lake just filled with rainwater, and it took people a long time to discover it. But it's not entirely clear where this water is from and how this lake has formed.
How remote is the area where the lake was discovered?
It's in the middle of a desert and it's very hot, which might explain why people might not have been walking around that part of Tunisia at this time of the year, because it's very hot here, and especially down in the south, it's around 40 degrees Celsius. So you would understand why it would take a certain amount of time for this lake to be discovered.
Well, since its discovery, I understand a number of people have visited the lake and bathed there. Are there concerns about the quality of the water?
Yeah, there's a lot of people visiting the lake. There are pictures of people jumping off the cliffs into the lake, swimming. I have to say the local authorities are warning against swimming in the lake because it's not entirely clear how safe the water is. The main concern is that because it's a phosphate mining area, that phosphate residue might still be in the water, and that the residue might be radioactive. So people have been told to stay away from the water and from the lake, but they have been largely ignoring those warnings.
And have there been any signs of illness as a result of the water?
No, not yet, but that could also take a while. I mean, we don't have any reports of people falling ill. The other problem we have is that this water has turned from turquoise to sort of muddy green, and that suggests that the water isn't changing and that the lake is not being replenished. And that could also mean that diseases and bacteria can grow especially at this temperature.
Well, we'll be keeping an eye on the mysterious nature of this lake. That was Navina Couture talking to us from Tunisia. Well, from one drought-stricken region to the next. In California, farmers are struggling with record drought. It's proving to be a tough time for large and small-scale farmers as the drought leaches their produce. This spring, researchers from the University of California reported that it could cost the agricultural industry as much as $1.7 billion US dollars as the drought hits its third year. And of the small amount of food that gets produced by US farms, 40% doesn't even make it to the dinner table. Farmers often can't sell their produce before it spoils or it doesn't meet the stringent aesthetic standards set by supermarkets. But now one social media venture in Northern California is trying to reduce food waste and keep small farms from going under. Their solution is to distribute to consumers food that would otherwise be normally thrown out. Jacep Resnick has the story.
We're in farm country in western Sonoma County, where towering eucalyptus trees, grazing cattle, and rows of vegetable crops are pretty much all you see. This is Bloomfield Organics, a 42-acre farm that began more than a decade ago when organic produce was still a small niche market. But one thing this farm, like most others, struggles to do is to get its produce to market, despite being only an hour's drive from San Francisco.
It's unacceptable to have a mindset that food should go to waste.
That's the farm owner's son-in-law, Nick Papadopoulos. About a year ago, he was hired as the farm's general manager after working as an efficiency consultant for some of the largest corporations in the world. Papadopoulos opens a cooler door where unsold produce is often stacked up. It was here where he learned just how inefficient farming can be.
And I'm literally standing right here, and I look in that corner, and similar to what you see now, there was a large pile of boxes. And I look in the boxes, and I'm like, what the heck? This is crazy. We have premium organic food that we've invested a lot of money in growing, a lot of natural resources, and, you know, as a small farm, a lot of love. And it didn't get to people. And that hit me across the head like a 2x4. And for the first time, I had noticed that that was a reoccurring pattern for our farm.
He decided to do something about it. The answer, he reasoned, was social media.
I saw the food. I recognized that it was going to the chickens or to the compost pile, and I decided, with the permission of the family, to launch a series of social media experiments. And so what I did was I wrote a short note to our online community, and I said, hey, team, we've got all this wonderful, sellable, nutritious food. It's a loss for us for various reasons, and it's a loss for you, the community.
It worked. Within hours, people online responded. The food found a home, and the farm recovered some of its costs. The website, called Crop Mobster, is an efficient way to reduce food waste, says Papadopoulos.
Any farm, any grocer, anyone can post an alert on Crop Mobster. And what happens is when that alert is refined to tell the story not just of the commodity, but a little bit about the struggle in that particular situation or actually emergency, it goes out in real time, email, and different social media channels.
And because the messages are also personalized, people want to help.
Members of the community, whether they're individuals, small businesses, or hunger relievers, take a personal interest not only to help themselves, but to invest themselves and roll up their sleeves to help solve the problem with community crowdsourcing.
We'll just see here. Oh, look, blue tomatoes coming out.
The farm's owner, Michael Collins, sitting astride a tractor, says the website has really helped to reduce waste and save money.
Crop Mobsters, I don't keep track of it, but I know it's things, okay, we're going to put that on Crop Mobster and because we just can't move it, and boom, you know, so that happens, and it's fantastic to not have to even think about it, because usually things just get disked under. You can hear the tractor in the background.
Colin says fellow farmers are getting enthused about using social media and predicts it'll continue to grow.
It's going to blow up. It's going to get more and more exciting. It's going to be a thing. Hopefully it goes worldwide.
Papadopoulos later transitioned from managing the family farm to running the site full-time. He's since been invited to New York to attend working groups with the United Nations as researchers and advocates attempt to struggle with a huge challenge of reducing food waste. It's not an insignificant problem. A report last September from the UN's Food and Agriculture Organization found that 1/3 of the world's food supply is wasted. The ramifications are huge for humanitarian, economic, and ecological reasons. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency reported last year that nearly a quarter of all methane, a greenhouse gas that contributes to climate change, is produced by uneaten food that's been dumped in landfill. That's led Papadopoulos to go from corporate efficiency consultant to farm manager to social media innovator to food waste activist.
1/3 of the global food supply is completely wasted. It doesn't get to people. And when you set that in the context of a growing population and about 1 billion people who are looking for their next meal, literally, and are food insecure, to have that level of supply and that ferocious level of demand, and yet the dots not being connected, that's a real crisis as well as an opportunity.
So is it working? Roughly 1 year on, Crop Mobster has seen about 400 alerts and less than 1,000 people sign up. It's still limited to the San Francisco Bay Area and runs largely on donations. The site's operators are trying to figure out how to spread the platform more widely. Meanwhile, in this part of Northern California, the drought is hitting hard.
got here, I've only planted, you know, maybe an eighth of what I would normally plant.
On a small orchard outside Santa Rosa, retired actor turned farmer Don Rosenberg demonstrates how the drought has been ravaging his fruit trees. But last month, he found himself left with boxes and boxes of ripening apricots. So he posted an alert on Crop Mobster with a plea for people to take the fruit before it spoiled.
Everybody came back. Everybody except for one person came out with a box of apricots.
Rosenberg says at first he was a bit skeptical, but he saw instant results.
It was pretty simple. I put the ad in. I said, I've got all of this, and you know, this is what the wholesale price is. And I thought, you know, they have to go. They have to be eaten. And my neighbor over here said, gee, Don, this must have 20 people coming here.
For Rosenberg, it was heartening not to have to compost perfectly good fruit and also to meet people face-to-face that appreciated his work. Plus, getting people thinking about the problem and farmers realizing they can tap into direct markets could make a difference. Back at his own farm, Papadopoulos says he hopes humans can come together to reverse destructive trends that are hurting farmers and the planet.
Right now, one-third of global food production is wasted. So in 5 years, I want to see us move the needle and reduce that number. And I want to see our social venture, Crop Mobster, make a contribution to that.
So far, Crop Mobster has managed to distribute nearly 500,000 kilos of food, which has brought in close to $1 million in revenue for small producers. That's good news for small farmers and good news for consumers seeking affordable, nutritious food that would otherwise be wasted. Jacob Resnick, DW, Sonoma County, California.
As we've heard, food waste is a major global problem, and Sao Paulo is no exception. In South America's largest metropolis, locals are turning abandoned spaces into productive vegetable gardens. Not only is it reducing the city's carbon footprint, but it's also having some social benefits too. DW reporter Milton Bragacci found out more and brings us this report from Brazil.
Oranges, pineapples, strawberries, two boxes for the price of one, scream the vendors as they compete for customers. The intoxicating smell of the various meat, fish, fruit and vegetables linger down the hundreds of stalls lining the street Odilon Pires, a typical scene for traditional street markets in São Paulo. Every day in São Paulo, 122 vegetable street markets set up to sell their fresh produce, and most neighborhoods have their own weekly markets lining the main street. The produce sold here comes from all over Brazil, traveling long distances to get here in the eastern district of Zona Leste. But of course, it doesn't all sell. The city's Department of Agriculture estimates that more than 1,000 tons of food gets thrown away every day at the São Paulo food markets. These, plus the groceries discarded by the country's supermarkets, accounts for one quarter of all wasted fruit and vegetables produced in Brazil.
Água.
Just a few blocks from the street fair is a small plot of land nestled among the houses. An elderly man waters lush lettuce, cabbage, herbs, and all kinds of greens spread across the soil. 65-year-old José Vieira used to be unemployed, but now, thanks to this garden, he has found a new job and renewed happiness.
Acordo 5 horas e aí começo a fazer o canteiro.
Every day I arrive at 5 in the morning and begin to see to the flower beds, watering them and seeing the joy of the plants, which makes me happy. It looks so beautiful. Like this land here, we have several other abandoned plots in the city, full of dirt, garbage, insects, and they're a huge contribution to the community.
The city garden grows food for local communities and helps the unemployed find work. The concept was developed by a local NGO called Cidade Sem Fome, or Cities Without Hunger. They want to transform the entire district by creating urban organic farms and vegetable gardens. The organization's founder, Hans-Dieter Temp, an agricultural and environmental policy graduate, came up with the idea and decided to put it into practice.
The idea came from a demand in the city. I researched and found out that food was the main need of the community. We knew that a lot of people were out of work, needing jobs, and we also noticed that there were many empty and unused plots of land in the city. So the idea for this project was a perfect way to solve all these problems.
In 10 years, Hans and his staff have set up more than 20 urban organic farms and gardens in São Paulo. And so far, it's proven very popular, says Hans.
They buy everything that is produced in this community garden. Why? Because here, they choose exactly what they want, and they see it being harvested. And because they live very close, they buy it daily, always fresh, avoiding having it in the fridge and throwing half of it in the trash bin.
Not only has it changed the way people shop, but it's also changed how people consume. The prices are usually 30 to 50% cheaper than other markets. But the main selling point is that it's locally produced and convenient.
The vegetable gardens end up changing the eating habits of the community. Instead of rice, beans, meat and soda, they eat a variety of produce from the garden, fruits such as tangerine, orange and mango.
Just down the road from the garden, Dona Rita de Cássia is in the kitchen preparing her family's next meal. The retired housemaid washes the vegetables she chose and hand-picked from the vegetable garden.
It's been many years since I've been buying vegetables here, because they are cheaper and always very fresh. In the street market, the products are not like this. Here we have lettuce, coriander, all very good stuff. With the coriander, I will prepare a very tasty soup.
Farms are located mostly in the city's poorer areas, but even fancy neighborhoods are adopting the concept. The farms and gardens are run using local and international donations, and also the profits made from selling of the fruits and vegetables. The vegetable gardens feed the local community and also act as a vital component of sustainable urban development, says Hans.
Muitas pessoas que iriam ou na feira ou no supermercado tirariam seus carros das garagens.
People who would have to go to the supermarket far from here and would take their cars from the garage don't have to do it anymore. So there is a reduction of fuel consumption and air pollution, which contributes to the planet with a greater sustainability.
Uma sustentabilidade ambiental muito maior.
The urban gardens not only reduce the need for cars to go shopping, but also the trucks used to transport food to the markets, therefore helping lower the city's carbon emissions. The gardens are also organic and don't require any pesticides for food production. Apart from their convenience and environmental benefits, urban gardens also have social benefits too.
A proposta da cidade sem fome é assim, é trazer para uma cidade.
The aim of cities without hunger is to transform grey cities like São Paulo, where the cement rains, and bring plants and nature, but with a social function. So we do not only want to bring food, job opportunity and income, but also want to build a happier city and much more environmentally sustainable.
Uma metrópole mais ambientalmente sustentável.
Urban gardens like this one in Zona Leste are being replicated across the country. The dream of having fresh fruits and vegetables, hand-picked from people's backyard, is slowly becoming reality for many more communities in Brazil. Milton Bragatti, DW, São Paulo.
Next, we head to Latvia, where the issue of climate change doesn't appear to be a big concern for the population. In a recent poll, just 12% of Latvians said climate change should be a priority for the government. The number of people who value climate protection over swift economic growth for their country has almost halved in the past 7 years. That said, there are some Latvians in this small state trying to motivate others to engage in climate protection. DW's Gerda Gelge met up with a couple of climate activists in Riga.
Waves lap against a white sandy beach in the Gulf of Riga. Latvia's Baltic Sea coast curves around a considerable part of the country, and here the shore stretches as far as the eye can see. 29-year-old Elina Vansan walks along the sand, her pink scarf and dark hair flying around in the wind as she points towards the horizon.
And just imagine that. Our little Latvia has 500 kilometers of such coastline.
Vansan runs the local environmental NGO Latvian Green Movement. She says climate change is already taking its toll on this stretch of coast.
Latvia is without a doubt affected by climate change, and it has a direct effect on the quality of the country's coastline. It's already been proven that coastal erosion is happening in some places, and that it's obviously caused by climate change.
For the past 5 years, Vansan has been actively engaged in climate protection. And while she's always been interested in environmental issues, it was by accident that she became a climate change activist.
Every so often, you're in the right place at the right time, and you meet the right people. Actually, I could say that climate protection chose me, and I got engaged in the work very quickly. And at some point, I realized that it is a very significant part of my life.
Vansan works with an organization called Latvian Green Movement to raise public awareness about climate change and to also encourage local officials and non-government organizations to work together on the issue, which she says isn't easy.
That's the hidden aspect of my work. It's not just occasional campaigns, rather continuous and intensive work.
Though the work is demanding, Vansan's motivation and enthusiasm for the environment are what drive her.
If I didn't believe in the idea and in the things I do, then I wouldn't be able to do the work. It's the people who try, act, and don't give up that are the main source of inspiration and motivation for me in Latvia. There's a lot you can learn from such people.
39-year-old activist Jānis Brizga, who works with the Latvian NGO Green Freedom, has been involved in the country's green movement for decades. Over the years, he's tackled all sorts of global and local issues, but more recently, most of his time has been taken up by efforts to curb greenhouse gas emissions.
Climate change is one of the most important issues in environmental protection at the moment. If you compare Latvia to more industrialized countries, then its emissions are perhaps not that high. But still, energy, electricity and heating are among the sectors that produce the largest emissions. But we have achieved a rather large reduction of emissions since the beginning of the 1990s when the Soviet Union collapsed.
But according to Brizga, CO2 emissions have risen in certain areas. This is because more and more people are choosing to travel by car. And a big problem, he says, is that only 12% of Latvians believe the government should be taking action to mitigate global warming.
I think that it's connected to people's priorities. They are first and foremost concerned about their work and their income. These questions have a higher priority than climate change.
When it comes to climate change, many people still have doubts about whether it exists. Vansan says this makes it difficult to talk about climate change and relate it to people's daily lives.
Quite often people think about climate change as some faith or religion. They ask, do you believe in climate change? Like it's the same as asking, do you believe in God? But when you have the facts and the knowledge, and you see the causes and effects, and the role of the people, you realize that you do have a big choice.
But Vansan is an optimist. She hopes more and more Latvians will start taking up the fight to protect the planet and the coastline in the Gulf of Riga. Both her and Brizga believe that small steps are the only way to achieve change. Jadars Jēles, DW, Riga, Latvia.
Next, we head back to the farm, where farm sensors are being designed for more efficient farming. If we want to keep up with global demands for food, we'll need more grain and probably more fields. But environmentalists say that's unsustainable. So instead, they want to see more intensive cultivation and more productive plants. And researchers are testing high-tech farm sensors that will identify plants infested with parasites or which corner of the field is best for which particular crop. Carla Blacker brings us this report by Fabian Schmidt.
Imagine a tractor slash fork truck lifting up an office cubicle. That's what's happening in this field in Klein Altendorf, a village near Bonn. A student with a laptop is hovering 4 meters over a barley field. Connected to his computer is a box with a revolving laser scanner. And the machine is taking 3D pictures of the field below, as Nora Tilly from the University of Cologne explains.
The first time we come out is before the plants begin to grow, and we make a high-definition digital model of the field surface. Once the plants start to grow, we come out every other week to measure the plants, and we get their height in a resolution of 1 centimeter.
In der Auflösung von 1 centimeter. The resulting three-dimensional images show the plant's growth. The researchers deduct the plant's biomass from their height and take random manual readings to check the results. A plant's growth rate, however, is just one of many factors researchers need to consider when assessing which types of grain are most successful. For instance, the soil properties in a single field can be quite irregular, and that can influence the levels of moisture and nutrients the plant has at its disposal. Heiner Goldbach is an agricultural scientist at the University of Bonn.
Es gibt deutliche Unterschiede und dadurch kann es durchaus sein, dass er sagt.
You might say this strain looks better, when in fact the difference lies in the different soil properties. That's why we need more data about the field and the crops.
Information über den Standort, an dem er seine Züchtung durchführt.
Some sensors can be used to detect radioactive elements in the soil or measure the level of clay and sand. This data is especially interesting for winemakers, says student Tobias Hegemann.
For cultivating vines, it's extremely important to detect even small heterogeneities. Different kinds of vines need different things from the soil. So we need to ask, which soil tastes good? And what soil do these vines need to grow well?
One of the biggest problems farmers have is parasites. Hairworms, or nematodes for example, are parasites that attack the roots of sugar beets. To find them, you would normally have to pluck the sugar beet from the ground. But Bonn University's Birgit Fricke lets the beet grow. She checks crops for parasites by using a spectral sensor that measures light waves.
Also wir haben das Sonnenlicht, was auf die Pflanze auftrifft.
Most of the sunlight that hits the crop is reflected immediately. But part of the light goes into the leaf and is transmitted by the crop's photosynthesis apparatus before it's reflected back.
Und wird wieder auch zurückgestrahlt.
A plant's reflection signal varies depending on how much stress it is under. If a sugar beet is infected with parasites, it reflects light differently than a healthy plant.
Und bin ich in der Lage, meine spektralen Daten?
I can evaluate the spectral data and learn about the sugar beet's nematode infestation. And all that non-invasively. That's how I do early diagnosis on the field.
Die frühe Diagnosen bereits machen zu können.
The goal is to cultivate more resistant or tolerant beet species. Spectral sensors can be used to learn about a plant's growth in soils with different levels of nutrients, and much more. Franz Ferdinand Gröblingshoff from South Westphalia Technical College compares the data his reflection sensors yield to data measured by the wheat harvester.
Da wird die Erntemenge auf dem Parzellenmähdrescher gewogen.
The amount of grain is weighed by a sensor on the harvester. That's also how we get information about moisture and other factors.
Über feuchte und sonstige Informationen zum Erntegut.
The sensors are allowing researchers to paint a detailed picture of farming today. And the hope is their sensors will give farmers the information they need on the best treatment, species, fertilizing, soil and more. Agricultural Professor Heiner Goldbach.
Ein Züchter wird müde. Man weiß, dass spätestens nach 2 Stunden auf dem Feld.
A farmer gets tired after 2 hours on the field in the heat. He's more likely to make mistakes, and the farmers themselves are aware that the later the day, the higher the danger is that they will use the wrong grains or accidentally discard good ones.
Beim Züchtungsprogramm, die steigt im Verlauf des Tages deutlich an.
Sensors, meanwhile, run smoothly all day long.
That brings us to the end of this edition of Living Planet. You can download episodes or replay them at dw.de. I'm Charlotta Lomas. We'll be back again next week with more news and stories about the environment. Until then, from all of us here in the studio in Bonn, thanks for listening.